Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
I'm really looking forward to kicking into this next episode with Matt of Thrive Deeper. But just before we do, I've got some really exciting news for you. This is Stuart from the Thrive Deeper Network. Now, many people tune into a Thrive podcast every week. In fact, we are close to hitting 70,000 downloads from around the world since we started Thrive Deeper some 4 years ago. That's 70,000 downloads, or 70,000 people potentially, who have tuned in and listened to a Thrive Deeper podcast since we started. That's really exciting, and we're really encouraged by the feedback we receive on how these podcasts impact people's lives in very real ways. Now, our hope and desire is to continue to make the Thrive podcasts available for free. However, there are very real costs to make this happen. So, if you'd like to contribute to assist us in meeting some of these ongoing production and distribution costs, then we'd ask you to join our listener support program with a monthly subscription. Now, you can do this very quickly and simply. Here's how you do it. Just go to thrivetoday.tv. On your internet browser, thrivetoday.tv. At the top of the homepage, you'll see a button that says Donate. This will give you the option to support the Thrive podcast with a donation of $5 or $10 or $50 per month. You can set your own support level, whatever's achievable for you. So we hope you'll consider supporting this ministry in this way. To those who are monthly supporters, a really big thank you. Your contribution is helping us continue to provide the Thrive podcasts to people around the world for free. Now let's get on to this next episode of Thrive Deeper with Matt. So
that's
cold morning, but it's a bit warmer in here, thankfully.
It is.
The heater is on.
Yes, we're on a Saturday morning here.
We are.
Huddled in the studio. You know, I'm a little relieved actually today because I'm relieved at the destruction of the Northern Kingdom of Israel. I know this sounds funny.
Okay.
But because now we only have one strand to deal with.
That's right.
They're gone. And we're just looking at the kings of Judah. So yeah. It's a little, okay, it's going to be a little simpler today. The jumping between the, and it is complicated to read for that purpose, isn't it, Kings?
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of people have said to me, oh, it's so complicated to follow. Mm. A good hint is to actually just try to pick up on patterns and things like that. What are the repeated things? You know, make observation, because it actually is really rich. That those things are really rich in the text. Mm. There's a way of reading these texts, and I think with these stories, there are patterns. Mm. It's like, oh, this happened before, and that happened, and this is this thing
and
again,
therefore,
and this repeated statement that happens all the way through. So, I have, you know. One of the things I've always done as a Bible reader is I've done lots of highlighting, and you know, I used to wear Bibles out because I would get different coloured highlighters and
couldn't read them anymore.
No, so much so that I couldn't, and then I'd put that one aside and start a new one.
Right.
Now,
well, before we jump in, let's get to here. We're at Deeper Places, episode 149. We are still in Kings, although we've only got a couple of episode, one more to go, and we'll be moving out of the Book of Kings, but let's not rush out. We're going to be largely covering 2 Kings 18 through to 2 Kings 23. So really from Hezekiah through to Josiah in Judah. But before we jump in there, Matt, I kind of feel like we at the end of our last podcast, we kind of summarized what had happened in Israel, which is mentioned in chapter 17 of 2 Kings, but we kind of skipped past Ahaz, and there's some, which is the king of Judah, right prior to Hezekiah, and there's probably some pretty important stuff we need to talk about, just a little bit about Ahaz. So let's jump in there, back at chapter 16 really, and just have a look at what happens here with Ahaz, and particularly his engagement with Uzziah.
Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing about this period is that this is going to be appear after the destruction of the Northern Kingdom of Israel, and Ahaz kind of overlaps with that period.
Yes,
this is actually going to be a period of great prosperity for Judah in the south. Judah was in some ways probably diminished by the prosperity of the north, the northern kingdom of Israel, those northern tribes. I mean, it may be because very rich countryside actually up in the north. It's much greener. You get once you go down south, it's a little bit more arid. That perhaps could be part of it, but it was always the wealthy,
right.
You know, the rich cousin really, yes, in the north. Yep. Whereas Judah now really comes to prominence, and you know, Jerusalem comes to prominence as a real important city in that area. Mm. Before probably more Samaria and up there in the north. So this is a time of great prosperity. Ahaz becomes king of Judah. Ahaz is a real politician, but he's this is the first of the real bad king. I mean, we've had bad kings in the south,
yeah,
but he's and you would think, wouldn't you, that they would look
at the north,
look
at
what happened in the north.
Let's not be that. Yep.
Yeah, let's not go where they went. But actually, it's not. In fact, it says here in 2 Kings 16 that it says, unlike David his father, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He followed the ways of the kings of Israel, and even sacrificed his son in the fire, engaging in the detestable practice of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He offered sacrifice and burnt incense at high place on the hilltops and under every spreading tree. I mean, this guy's he really goes the whole hog now. And so, ironically, at this very time, he is every bit as bad, if not worse, perhaps, than the kings in the north.
Yes. Yep.
Now, as you said, this is the time when Isaiah is prophesying as well. So Isaiah is very active here.
Yeah.
And there is there's a situation. In fact, the very famous Isaiah chapter seven prophecy. Mm. Happens sort of early in his reign. Isaiah chapter 7 prophecy is the virgin or the young woman in Hebrew, yes, the same thing, will give birth and have a child. And the context for that, because we know that prophecy very well, actually what the prophecy in its original context is saying, because there was this alliance of the northern king of Israel,
yes,
Pekah, one of the last of the kings. So this is just before the fall. And when I say about a decade before the fall of Israel,
yeah,
so early in Ahaz's reign, he forms an alliance with Aram, and they basically a threat to, yes, Ahaz. Isaiah comes to Ahaz, says, by the time this child, here's the prophecy, a young woman will give birth to a child. By the time the child grows old enough to tell good from bad, so, you know, probably around the age of 14, these kingdoms are going to be completely decimated
by
the king of Assyria.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this is interesting that, you know, at that stage, you've got a bad king, but Isaiah is saying, don't worry about them, because they're going to be destroyed. But I think in that destruction that's going to happen, it happens during Ahaz's time.
Yes.
There's a bit of a warning there as well, because Judah is no better. And this is the interesting thing. At this point, Judah is no better. Yeah. And yet at this time, it's the northern kingdom that falls, and God's just holding on. And for the sake of his covenant with David, Judah has done better. Judah hasn't had the same patterns. You've got a really bad king in Ahaz right now. But God is preserving Judah.
Yeah.
And Judah's going to hold out because the next king, Hezekiah is going to be a godly man.
Yes.
And he's going to hold out while the northern kingdom gets destroyed. So this is a really interesting story. Ahaz becomes a bit of a he actually, in fact, despite that prophecy, rather than just trusting in God, he actually sends off to the king of Assyria.
Yes, that's right.
I think maybe, you know, Isaiah says, don't worry about the the Ammonites and the Israelites up in the north. The king of Assyria is going to come and wipe them out. So
make peace with the king of Assyria, essentially.
Yes. So he sends letters to the king of Assyria saying, you know, come and help me.
Yeah.
I'll make peace with you. I'm not sure if that was the idea. I don't think the idea wasn't for him to really lean on the king of Assyria. The prophecy was meant to just say, this is going to happen.
Yes.
And with a implied warning, make sure you don't act like them. Mm. But he, you know, he calls on the king of Assyria, goes up to Damascus. Mm. When the king of Assyria is coming down, he goes up to Damascus. The king of Assyria's won these, you know, clearly the victor now in that area. And he just takes on, right, I'm going to become an Assyrian. He goes the whole, I'm just going to, hey everyone, we're going to become Assyrians now. And he, you know, imports the Assyrian cult and an altar from Damascus he brings back, and he just completely gives way to their customs and their worship. So, in fact, it says, you know, he does certain things to the temple in deference to the king of Assyria. It's not that it was even required. He just goes beyond because he wants to really make friends with, he's going to worship their gods. And of course he's thinking, well, look, their gods seem to have prevailed here. So I guess I'll worship their gods.
Yeah. And we're going to hear more about that in Hezekiah when, you know.
That's important background you know, that idea, oh, their gods are stronger.
Yeah.
So I'll worship their gods. Now, what's going to happen when the Assyrians are going to come down and besiege the city of Jerusalem? Mm. Assyrians are going to say exactly the same thing. Like, hey, our gods have beaten every other gods. Don't think that your God is going to hold on out against us. So the background is Ahaz's lack of faith is going to be shown up by Hezekiah's faith in this situation. So that's probably all we need to say about Ahaz.
Sets the scene for
really Hezekiah. Bad guy. Yeah. God's still speaking. Hezekiah comes to the throne. Hezekiah's one of the greatest kings, probably, you know, bettered by, not probably, definitely bettered by Josiah later. We're going to have a look at these two kings mainly today. Mm. Hezekiah, no, actually, we're going to talk about Manasseh as well. Hezekiah and Josiah are the two really great, you know, I mean, really good, you know, who brought about great reforms.
Yes.
Josiah is probably the greatest of those. Hezekiah has a bit of a lapse later on in his life. He becomes proud.
Here's Hezekiah coming to Judah, you know, a godly king, but right at the time where probably Judah is facing, or Jerusalem in particular, the greatest threat it's ever faced and ever known in terms of the attack from Assyria.
That's right. And in a sense, it's interesting. I'm looking over at your Bible and you've got a map open, which reminds me to say, Stu, that even though this area is a bit of a backwater in some respects, it's important because it's the gateway, it's the bridge, the land bridge, in a sense, down to Egypt. So Judah is sandwiched between these great empires now. This is now the era of great empires. Mm. You know, if you went back, say, 500 years early, you've got smaller nation states, really. Now you've got big empires forming.
Yes.
Look, Egypt was already a force to be reckoned with.
Babylon was
earlier, but unchallenged.
Yep.
In some respects. Now you've got these big empires starting to clash. And the interesting thing, this is the interesting thing about this area called the Promised Land. You often wonder, why there, of all the places, why there? You know, I think heard someone point out, you know, the irony of the fact that God put his people in the only piece of land in the Middle East without oil.
That's right.
So it was not about the oil. It's because it was this gateway, it was a crossroads between, you know, between Egypt, you know, it was where, you know, Phoenicia was where you got on a boat west to Italy and so forth. It was this crossroads place where if you had a message that you wanted to get out to the world,
good place to be.
That's the best place to be.
It's like the street.
Everyone
corner.
Came by your door.
That's
Everyone
right.
came by your door. Now, the problem is that you're also in the middle of the trouble. I mean, everyone wants to control this piece of land because this is the bridge.
Yeah.
We all want to control the bridge, right?
Yeah.
So they're caught in between, you know, and this is why you know, the northern kingdom, which tries to hold out, they get completely decimated.
Yeah.
Hezekiah, you know, is ruling in the south while this is happening. Now, the interesting pattern here, there's an interesting pattern in how the way that this story is told, particularly in Chronicles, because Chronicles puts a lot of, and you get this in Kings as well. He is first and foremost a reformer. You get this sense
yes.
that he turns the people back to God, and then it's Jesus talking about the house built on the sand and the rock. I mean, when Jesus talked about, you know, the house on the sand and the house on the rock, and the storm came and the house on the rock stood while the house built on the sand got washed away, that could have been a commentary on the events that are happening right now in terms of Judah in the south and Israel in the north, because Israel are the house built on the sand. What we see Hezekiah doing right here is building his house on the rock.
Yeah.
And then the storm's going to come and it's going to wipe out the northern kingdom. But he's going to remain still. Amazingly, actually, even today, from a secular history point of view, it is actually amazing that everything gets wiped out in this whole region except Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And how on earth does that happen? You know, you've even, because there's a lot of history. There's a lot of Assyrian history, Babylonian history, Babylonian Chronicles. Record all of these things. We're well within recorded history now, because these events get recorded by the Babylonians as well.
And the reality is, Hezekiah came when he came into power. He knew they didn't have the resources in their own way to defeat or to defend Jerusalem from the Assyrians. No. So straight away he turns to God and goes,
"Yeah,
you're the only one who's really going to be able to save us here." Now he does have a bit of a lapse where he thinks he might be able to,
buy off the king of Assyria. Yeah, and that costs him dearly, actually. So just the first thing to point the are those reform. Let's just really mark that.
Yep.
You know, he reinstitutes the temple services.
Yes,
that's really gone into disrepair. Think it's really been lost. A lot of that, the rhythms of life that were so crucial to being God's people, were lost. I mean, not unlike the times in which we live, when a lot of the rhythms, people have moved away from a lot of those rhythms. I think for us, the two years of lockdowns really sort of tested that. And I make that point because when I read that, I just thought about this is, this in a sense is a time of rebuilding. And for Hezekiah, he responded to that rebuilding call, reestablish the rhythms of worship, get those back into place, because there's a storm on the horizon coming. I mean, he didn't necessarily know that, although, Isaiah was... There were plenty of warnings in a sense. I mean, if you were listening to Isaiah during this time, and Isaiah is one of the key characters in the story of Hezekiah. Mm. So he builds his house on the rock so that when there's actually this moment where the reigning king of Assyria dies and... So Hezekiah, we know this from secular history. I'm giving you a bit of background here. So it's probably at this time that he withdraws paying tribute. He rebels against the king of Assyria, it said.
Yeah.
And most probably is the ring, because this tended to happen when a king died with these great empires. The small nation states, the vassal states that paid enormous tribute would rebel.
Yeah. Take the opportunity.
Yeah, to get clear, because they've got to come a long way to pull us into line. Mm. So Hezekiah does this. He rebels against the king of Assyria. There's a sense it's not just a political thing. There's a sense of his faith has been bolstered in a sense. We can stand against these guys. But he's most probably also, from a history point, he's most probably mobilizing some of the other states as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And he knows that they're going to come.
Yes. And he's knows getting prepared for that.
He's getting prepared for that.
Absolutely.
So the interesting thing is, I talked about the prosperity during this time, and this time for Hezekiah also is a time of great prosperity, and we know that from archaeology because Jerusalem quadruples in size during the reigns of Ahaz and particularly Hezekiah. Four times the size. Now, partly because once the northern kingdom is destroyed, a lot of people move
to the south.
Move to the south, like there are a lot of refugees. So he has to build these new walls right around the city. That's the one thing you can see. The Hezekiah's wall that's been excavated in the old city of Jerusalem.
Yeah,
you know, a quickly built wall because he knows it's quite a quickly built wall.
Yes,
and you can see it today.
Yeah.
Because he knows the Assyrians are on their way. One amazing thing that he does, he thinks, well. When the Assyrians come, we've got to cut off the water supply because he knows that they're gonna lay siege to the city.
Mm.
So he thinks I've got to not give them access to water. So what he does, he blocks off the spring, the Gihon spring that's outside the walls. He redirects it underground.
In a tunnel. Yep.
Yeah, he builds a tunnel. So underground, blocks it up. Underground, a tunnel that's
2,000 feet long. I think.
Yeah, 2,000 feet long. Yeah,
yeah, it's a decent tunnel.
Through rock, and you can walk. I've walked through the whole length of this tunnel.
Yeah,
and you can still all the chips, you know. Mm-hmm. And they did it from two different directions. To this day, no one knows how on earth they managed to actually meet, because they were going from two different directions, and it was redirected. So the water was redirected inside the walls on the western side of the city of David. So he was
getting prepared. He knew they were coming.
Yeah, and it was amazing engineering feat and done in a hurry and done accurately. So it's pretty amazing. And there was an inscription actually there as well about it. So this is what he's doing to prepare. He knows they're coming and come they do. They come up to the walls. They've destroyed all of these other cities.
Yep.
Notably, for the second time, actually, they've laid siege to and destroyed the city of Lachish, which was a very important city. We don't hear a lot about it in the Bible, but it was an important city. It says actually here in the story in 2 Kings 18 that the commander of the armies of Assyria came from Lachish over to Jerusalem.
Mm.
Basically, they're saying, hey, look what we just did to Lachish, the city of Lachish. We're going to do that to you as well. And don't think your God's going to save you. And actually, you can see today in the British Museum, next time you're in London, Stu.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks, go to the British Museum. And there are these massive carvings that were originally from the walls of the palaces of the king of Babylon, of the king of Assyria in Nineveh, from the palaces in Nineveh, carvings of the siege of Lachish. It's like the whole narrative from the armies coming in, marching in to the siege. You've got all of this detail, siege ramps.
Mm.
The whole thing is pictured in so much detail. A lot of gory detail, what happens to the people when they get captured and, these depictions of people impaled on poles and being all sorts of terrible things happening. Mm-hmm. Because this was to drive fear.
Yes.
The fear was their weapon.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The Assyrians treated their captives terribly and they lined the roads with people impaled on poles. So when they come to Jerusalem...
Yep.
People have retreated into Jerusalem.
Mm.
They've heard about what they just did.
Mm.
Fear is now the big tool of the commander.
Yeah.
You need to submit to us, or this is going. Now, of course, he tries to buy him off. As you said, he tries to buy him off first.
In some ways, you can kind of understand that, though, can't you? With that,
the level of fear.
Thinking
that's
about
right.
Your loved ones and your family and the people that you know, and realizing this could happen. There's got to be a way to.
That's right, and it's not far away that this is happening.
That's exactly
it's
right.
not far away at all. Yeah. So Hezekiah tries to buy him off at first. That doesn't work.
Mm.
He comes to the walls. Then there is this speech.
Yes.
you know,
that escalates.
You don't it's, you know, shouts to the people along the walls. Don't listen to King Hezekiah. Your God's not going to save you. No God has been able to stand against us, us and the gods of Assyria. You're doomed. In the Babylonian Chronicle, it says that they trapped Hezekiah and the people of Jerusalem up like a bird in a cage.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, it actually stops, doesn't say, and it's the interesting thing about the Babylonian Chronicle is it talks a lot about all Lachish. Of these others, well, Lachish other cities, Lachish. But Lachish was just a
staging ground. You know,
it was an important city, but it wasn't the capital.
No, that's right.
So there's this glaring kind of a question, well, hang on, but, you know, what about Jerusalem? Because, of course, they never talked about their failures. Well, Jerusalem is going to become a major failure for the Assyrians, as we're going to see. So,
and interesting too, the representative of the king of Assyria is speaking in Hebrew because he wants all the people on the wall to hear, because exactly that point.
He's using to fear. Terrify them. That's exactly right. He's using fear. And he thinks that this is going to put...
This is a private negotiation. I'm going to make sure everyone knows.
It's going
to
put pressure on the king.
Exactly.
And, you know, this kind of thing, they did this because it worked normally.
Yes.
They would go to one city, an easier target. They would absolutely decimate that city. They would pull the people out. They would unleash all sorts of terrors on the people in order to, inflict fear and to sort of submit through the use of fear, the next target. That's what they're doing here. Now, this is where the house built on the rock now doesn't fall. I mean, it staggers, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
You know, because he thinks, I'm going to try. The first thing he does is try to buy them off, but then that doesn't work. Yeah. And he's really pushed against the wall. And here it's like now he's got no one else to turn to except God. And so, I love this story. In fact, it's told, this is such an important story, it's told three times in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah, in the book of Chronicles, and here in the book of Kings, as well as, of course, in the Babylonian Chronicles. So it says, when Hezekiah heard this, the words of the commanders of the Assyrian army, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth, went into the temple of the Lord. You know, and he lays the letter out that they've given him before the Lord, and Isaiah comes and speaks to him and says, it's quite a remarkable, prophecy, you know,
and
that.
Absolutely. And the way Hezekiah kind of, comes at it from the perspective of not so much their safety or prosperity, but more the fact that he wants to defend God's honor. This guy has said that you're just a no god, like all these other gods.
Yeah. His appeal.
Exactly right.
And it's Hezekiah's prayer stands in the tradition of great intercessory prayers that have an appeal. Lord, it's your glory at stake
that's
here.
Right.
It's not just about it. You know, these and these prayers are recorded because this is like, this is a man who has a heart for God, right? Mm. So when the city's threatened, the thing that that enrages him the most is that they have said that their gods are greater.
Yeah.
They've cursed the God of Israel.
Yes.
They've unleashed slanders upon the God of Israel. So this is when you get this amazing answer from Isaiah, you know, towards the end in verse 32, he will not enter this city. He will not shoot an arrow here. Mm. He will not come before it with a shield, or he will not build a siege ramp again. What a remarkable prophecy.
Yeah, that's right.
To say, he's not going to shoot one arrow.
Mm. Mm.
Like the whole army is all, you can almost hear Hezekiah saying, but they're actually already here.
They're at the door.
I mean, they're already here, you know.
Yep.
So how are they not going to do that? Like, what's got to happen for that? Well, this great, amazing verse here in 2 Kings 19:35. That night, the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 in the Assyrian camp. Mm. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew, returned to Nineveh and stayed there. And then he was actually killed by some of his officials. Now, the interesting thing about this, you think, oh, that's how could that? Well, I'm talking to the skeptics, of course, you know. But the thing is, we are well within history here.
Yes,
it's actually even there's a slightly garbled account in Herodotus, the Greek historian Herodotus, who records this account, most probably this account, when the Assyrian army was destroyed during a siege by some, I think he puts it down to like a plague of mice or something.
Right.
So the story, this story had got around enough for, you know, for Herodotus to pick up this story somewhere. I think he picks it up in Egypt or somewhere. This was a famous story in the ancient world of how this Assyrian army got destroyed by this plague. You know, whatever specifically, it's just amazing. And then, of course, you've got the records, the Assyrian records, boasting of all of the, you know, all of the victories of the little towns. But, yeah, what about Jerusalem?
No mention.
That's a conspicuous silence.
Were they kind of trying to make Lachish the big
yeah,
game?
That's right.
In fact, really.
Yeah, Jerusalem was the big game, but that you know, that doesn't work out. Yeah. So, you know, history really, really corresponds with this. To close off the life of Hezekiah, Hezekiah becomes ill.
Interesting, just before you move off, and it's just a little interesting thing that I noticed, is that the victory is won for Hezekiah in the temple, and the victory is won by God, by the king of Assyria.
In his temple. He dies in his temple, worshipping his God.
Worshipping his God, and he was killed in his temple. Anyway, just an interesting.
Yeah, that's isn't that a really interesting, and I think that the parallel there, again, the writer is recording that because he's saying God's speaking through this. So, you know, so here are two kings worshipping their gods. Yeah.
Let's see which God can protect. Now, let's see.
Yeah. You know? So his God, he's in his, you know, this is this incredibly powerful king in his temple. He gets killed when there is Hezekiah in his temple praying to his God with, you know, and hundreds of thousands, you know, all of these Assyrians out in the walls, and he survived. So, you know, this is, again, it's the house on the rock and the sand here. Hezekiah, it's interesting. Hezekiah becomes ill. He's told by the prophet Isaiah he's going to die. Hezekiah, you know, weeps and seeks God over this. He gets another 15 years.
Yes.
During this 15 years, this is Manasseh's born.
Yes.
You sort of think,
Manasseh, of course, is Hezekiah's son.
Yeah, Manasseh's Hezekiah's son, and Manasseh's going to be the worst of the worst. I mean, we thought Ahaz was bad. No, Manasseh's going to go going to go way worse than this. You sort of think, okay, maybe God's timing perhaps was best. It's also, there's a bit of pride here in these later years. This is a time of lapse as well. I mean, you know, you think it's interesting because, again, this is not just history. There's a prophetic message to this. It's like your time is your time. God knows your time. And what happens in this last 15 years isn't great.
No.
In fact, he becomes quite proud. You know, Manasseh's born during this time, this next king who's going to be brought up in this wealth and in this time of lapse, and he's going to become the king. So, you know, he boasts to these Babylonian envoys. They come and, you know, look how powerful I am.
And probably because they'd heard the story that it happened to the Assyrians.
Yeah.
So they were kind of, and so, you know, he's now, in a sense, almost trying to say, well, here's what we've got and why, when in fact, you know, his pride rather than God's kind of glory here and showing off all the trades, all the state secrets, really.
Yeah, that's right.
To the Babylonians.
Yeah, so his pride just is his downfall here because, you know, they come, I mean, you know, he's not really giving glory to God. Like you said, he's, you know, look how powerful, look how rich I am, aren't I great?
Yeah.
And they're thinking, this is a
that's right.
Like this is a nice little safe to invade and plunder. So Manasseh comes to the throne. He's only young. He's only 12 years old when he becomes king. But he's grown up, you know, in this last period. He's a bit of a spoilt brat.
There's probably a bit of an overlap too, where Hezekiah and Manasseh kind of reign.
That's right.
For a period of time.
Yeah, that's right.
Not long,
So he, you know, in summary, he goes the whole hog with everything. In fact, the writer says that he actually went worse than the nations. I mean, he was worse than the people of the nations around that God, you know, told them not to have anything to do. You know, he's worse than them. He's sacrificing his sons in the fire.
Yeah.
He's practicing divination, sorcery, witchcraft. This guy goes headfirst into the darkest of the dark, you know.
Sort of assimilates the Assyrian kind of religions.
Yeah. And again, you know, probably under pressure here. Remember, you're sandwiched in between big empires.
Yeah, yeah.
This is around the time when Babylon and Assyria are jostling a little bit. There's Assyria is still the force to be reckoned with.
Bit of a power
but
play.
Babylon, and that's, you know, the Babylon envoys sort of come around, perhaps even during the time of that co-regency.
Mm.
You know, they're in conflict with...
They're trying to get the measure of everyone around them.
And in fact, it may be that Manasseh, that during this time, what happened there with Hezekiah and those envoys probably means that Hezekiah was backing Babylon. Now, so Manasseh is going to follow this backing Babylon, but actually at first Babylon lose. There's initially a defeat where Assyria defeats Babylon. Now, eventually at the famous Battle of Carchemish, Babylon's going to destroy Assyria.
Mm.
But at least at first, they back the wrong horse, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that what happens is that, you know, Manasseh's doing all of this terrible stuff. It says in Kings that he filled Jerusalem from one end to the other with blood. Yep. It's like the streets were – it's terrible, terrible things going on. He's oppressing his own people.
And having just quickly having Hezekiah who'd gone into a process of restoration of the important things for God and doing away with the high places and the Baals, he's bringing all of that back again. New altars to Baal were built, you know, the pagan worship, rebuilt all the high places.
Yep.
So he went basically, the pendulum swung
that's right.
completely the other direction, as you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And so he led them to do worse than the nations, as I said, around them. This is when – so the king of Assyria – comes back probably because, and again, this is reconstructing history, but probably because they backed Babylon,
right.
He, you know, the king of Assyria comes and he takes Manasseh back. He takes him back to Babylon. They've defeated Babylon, remember?
At that point.
So the king of Assyria comes, takes him back to Babylon. Probably, you know, I mean, again, putting some pieces together. Hey, this is what happened to the horse that you backed, you know?
Yes, yeah.
For some, you know, and this is what it's interesting. The difference, there's a key difference now here between the account in Kings and the account in Chronicles, because the account of Kings just finishes. He's a terrible king.
Yes,
it was all bad, and leaves it there.
Yep.
Because for the writer of Kings, what matters is that this is a point of no return for the people of Judah. During Manasseh's reign, idolatry gets thrust so far into the heart of the nation that they're not really going to recover in it. You know, it's so even Josiah's reforms aren't going to fully, reverse
the damage.
Reverse the damage.
Mm.
Now,
and Kings, of course, was written while they were still in exile.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's right.
So they're really trying to look. The question they're really asking is, what went wrong?
What went wrong, Manasseh?
This is what went wrong.
Manasseh is kind of the. Because of the extremity to which he went in the bad. What the writer of Kings said, this is what led to that, right?
Yeah.
Now, remember, they're, you know, in exile, of course, and so the massive temptation is in exile is to be, in fact, that's why they took the people into exile, so they would assimilate and become Babylonians and, you know, practice all of the cultic practices of the Babylonians. So the Manasseh story is a cautionary story for the writer of Kings. The writer of Chronicles is writing to a people who have been restored, and is God really with us anymore?
Yes.
Now that we've come back to Jerusalem, we're starting over. Does God really is He really still with us? Well, this is where the chronicler goes back to the official records and tells us something that the writer of Kings wasn't as interested in.
Yeah.
And you know, Manasseh has this amazing turnaround that in his distress.
He cries out
because
to God.
And man, he would have been in distress too. They would have really he would have been treated terribly there. He cries out to God. He says, in his distress, he sought the favor of the Lord his God, and he humbled himself greatly before the God of his ancestors. This is
2 Chronicles 33,
verse 13 is truly to me one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible.
Mm.
And when he prayed to him, the Lord was moved by his entreaty. And listen to his plea.
Yeah.
So he brought him back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord is God.
Mm.
That verse, since my young Christian years has been absolutely unforgettable.
Yeah.
You know, and you can imagine for the exiles that even Manasseh.
Right? Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Even Manasseh was restored.
The worst
right?
of the worst.
And so he comes back from exile. Remember, you're talking to people who have been in exile and come back.
Yeah.
And like, okay, does God forgive us and what should we do now? Mm. Well, Manasseh comes back. Can imagine what the people are thinking. Oh yeah. God, what are you doing to bring him back? But he's a new man, isn't he?
Yes.
And he comes and he rebuilds the city and he gets rid of all the idols and he does his best in what remains of his rule, and he's probably very much a weakened man at this stage. But the people, it says that even here in Chronicles, the people continue to sacrifice at the high places and so forth. So you have this amazing turnaround, which what a message to these exiles. But going back to the story, his son rules after him when he dies for 2 years. Amon's been brought up, steeped in idolatry.
Yeah,
it's all right. So it's almost the damage is done in a sense. So yes, Manasseh himself was forgiven. The damage is done. Amon just returns everything back to the way that it was. Bring back the idols because we know that because when we get to Josiah, Josiah's got a heck of a lot of work to do, a lot of house cleaning to do.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about Josiah is that of all of the other kings, there was always a however he left the high places, or there was always something that they didn't do.
Yes.
Josiah,
he's
complete reform in that sense that he gets rid of all of the high places.
Yeah. He's one. You know how they repeat in the king. You know, he was a good king and did right on the side of the Lord. He's one of the few, I think. There may only be two, I think, where it actually says and walked in all the ways of his ancestor David. He did not turn to the right.
Yeah, that's right.
The left.
Yeah, and so there's no real downside to his rule. Exactly. You know, he doesn't. I mean, he's really quite. Quite a remarkable king.
Yeah.
All of this begins, of course, with the discovery of the book of the law. They read that it's all in response to this. During the exile and after the exile that a lot of emphasis is going to be put on, God's word, God's law, and responding to that. He goes about these amazing reforms, just completely cleans out the house, renews the covenant, institutes the Passover. It's just, quite a revival.
Passover hasn't been celebrated for over 500 years at that point in time. To the time of the judges, I think.
Not to this extent.
As a whole nation. Yeah.
So, you know, it says neither before nor after Josiah was there a king who turned to the Lord as he did.
Mm.
That's in verse 25. Now, in verse 26, it says, "Nevertheless, the Lord did not turn away from the heat of his fierce anger, which burned against Judah because of all that Manasseh had done to arouse his anger." All of this happens, and then within a decade, it's about 605.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. Within a decade
of
Josiah's time, the nation is completely destroyed.
Yeah.
Yep. And you think, hang on, what's the point of all of that? Because you have this string of kings who basically again revert back. And this shows how entrenched they had been. So there was a revival.
Yep.
The revival probably particularly impacted the lives of the younger generation, particularly the nobility, the core people really around Jerusalem. You get the sense that even though he did his best, I mean, he even went up to the northern kingdom.
Yeah, he did.
Called them to come down and become a part of this. And
he tore down the golden calf altar.
That's right.
He was the only one who actually went and dealt with those as well.
That's right. He tore down Jeroboam's altar.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he does all of this. It has limited impact, but it has impact.
Mm.
Now, because at the end of his reign, it's interesting that the way that he dies is it's a slightly unfortunate death, because what happens, the king of Egypt, we know from secular history, king of Egypt's coming north to actually fight the Battle of Carchemish in 609
BC.
He's passing through, they have to pass through the Jezreel Valley there, which is ruled at this time by Josiah. Right. They said, "Just let us part. We're coming. Part. We're not going to bother you. We're going to engage with the Babylon. You know, we're joining with the Assyrians to fight against Babylon." Josiah doesn't let them. Is not going to let them through. Mm. Now we don't know why.
Yeah.
We don't know that his reasons were bad or good, but he fights against them. He actually dies in that battle.
Yeah, he does. Yep.
That's the Battle of Carchemish. After the Battle of Carchemish, the Babylonians come down. They annex the area because, of course, after he dies. And this is, I think, the our answer to what, why this, and we'll finish with this, Stu.
Yeah.
Why this amazing revival just seemingly leads to nothing. No. This revival saves
the nation.
The nation.
Mm.
Because it basically, what you get in this revival arises a generation of young men steeped in the word.
Mm.
The children of Josiah's revival, people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, mm-hmm. people we read about in the exile. This remarkable faith seemingly out of nowhere. Well, no, it's not out of nowhere. These guys grew up in the midst of Josiah's revival. He was sowing seeds that were going to save the next generation. The Jewish people are going to continue to exist as a fact because of what Josiah did, because he planted seeds. He built that house on a rock. And yes, it was going to be buffeted, but the house wasn't the physical city. And this is in one of the changes, in a sense, that, you know, the house is actually the people, and the people are going to move. They're going to go into exile, but they are going to, you know, some of the most amazing visions of God in the whole Bible are actually given to God's people in that, the darkness of that exile. We see amazing faith. It's an amazing time. The seeds for that were sown by Josiah. Never, ever doubt the significance of small seeds, the seeds that we sow in our children, because God is always thinking multi-generationally, and who knows what's up ahead.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.